Hello, hello, episode 8. Can you believe it? I'm mildly surprised that I've been committed enough, to be honest. Part of me thought that I'd make 2 episodes and then bin it off, but no, here we are. I do have you lot to thank for that, as the response has been so kind and encouraging so far, so a big thank you to all of you. I have had over 100 downloads in the last month, which is absolutely amazing. I only know about 8 people, so it's very exciting for me. I also have an article coming out in the Waltham Forest Echo regarding hauntings in Leytonstone Tube Station, which is great. Should be out December 1st. So if you found me from there, hi, how are you? Please, all of you, keep telling your mates, get more people on board. I'm fairly sure that there's only been a handful of friendships ended over incessant podcast recommendations, so chances are they'll probably forgive you for badgering them. So, what are we doing? Where are we going for episode 8? This one is going to be similar to my very first episode in that it involves the tragic death of a spectacularly talented black musician taken far before his time. Please gather round, get a cuppa, put on a face mask, whatever you do to get comfortable, as we embark on episode 8, The Morose Murder of Marvin Gaye. Marvin Pence Gaye was born on April 2nd, 1939 in Washington, D.C. to a church minister, Marvin Gaye Sr., and mother, Alberta Gaye. His first home, the Fairfax Apartments, was a public housing project. The area is known as the Southwest Waterfront Area, and it is one of the oldest neighbourhoods in the city. It's home to many elegant homes and well-to-do people, but Southwest was regarded as a slum. Most buildings were in disrepair and had little access to water or electricity. Shacks were hastily built in alleyways to deal with the massive overcrowding that plagued most established housing. Not a great time when all is said and done, especially with the social and economic knock-on of that little old scrap called World War II that the US would join when Marvin was just 5 years old. Marvin was the second oldest of the Gaye brood. He had 2 sisters, Jean and Zola, and a brother, Frankie. He also had 2 half-brothers, Michael Cooper from his mother's previous marriage, and Antoine, born from his father's extramarital activities. Not very church of Marvin Sr. at all. Marvin started singing in church at 4 years old, his father often accompanying him on piano. Marvin's love of singing deepened, and he was encouraged to pursue it professionally after blowing the roof off of a school play he was in when he was 11 years old. I played Scar in my school's production of Lion King. Younger kids asked for autographs. All downhill after that, unfortunately. Despite his blossoming talent and passion for music, Marvin's home life was not kind. He was regularly beaten by his father for perceived transgressions from their faith. This treatment went on from the age of 7, well into his teenage years. He likened living with his father to living with a king, a cruel and all-powerful king. He also said that, if his mother had not been there to provide comfort and encourage his music, he would have likely killed himself. Gaye attended Randall Junior High School, where he furthered his pursuit of music by becoming a star of their Glee Club. If he was in Glee, I'd probably actually watch it. I feel like an argument could be made that the arrival of Glee signalled the end of times. An argument could be made. Maybe a future episode. Stick around for that one. Gaye then attended Cardozo High School. He joined several doo-wop groups, including the Dippers and DC Tones. During this time, he and his father argued more and their relationship worsened. He was kicked out of the house several times as a result of their fights. At 17, Gaye dropped out of high school and joined the Air Force as a basic airman. When he joined, he was assigned the general routine and menial tasks and decided this was all rather boring. Literally life. The amount of jobs I've had where they've been like, the state of someone's whole day, their whole existence rests on their interaction with you and how much you bend over backwards for them. I was folding shirts at the Gap, dude. So, a bit bored, Gaye did something interesting. He faked a mental illness and was discharged. He apparently refused to follow orders from his superior, so was binned. When he returned home, he formed a group called the Marquees with Bo Diddley. They released one song called Wyatt Earp, which failed to hit Tay-Tay Swift levels, and they were dropped from their label. They then changed their name to Harvey and the New Moonglows and released a few more tunes whilst acting as session musicians for the likes of Chuck Berry. In 1959, the group's song Mama Lucy became Gaye's first lead vocal performance. The group disbanded in 1960, but during the Christmas of that year, he performed at Berry Gordy's house. Berry was a producer and was very impressed with Marvin, signing him to Motown subsidiary Tamla. Originally, Gaye wanted to pursue jazz music, not really wanting to become an R&B artist. He also added the E at the end of his surname, much like fellow artist Sam Cooke, well known for being a subject on this very podcast. He was known for other stuff too. Mainly the podcast thing though. Joking, of course. This haberdash vowel adding was particularly impactful as it represented a further estrangement between Marvin and his father. In May 1961, Marvin released his first single, Let Your Conscience Be Your Guide, and his debut album, The Soulful Moods of Marvin Gaye. These weren't all too successful, and Gaye spent most of his time still working as a session musician, performing as a drummer for bands such as The Miracles for $5 a week, about $43 a week now cash. Despite people trying to help him improve his presence, Gaye was very stubborn. A lot of artists took dance lessons and elocution classes, but Marvin refused. One slight pointer he did take on board was to perform with his eyes open. People sometimes thought he had fallen asleep whilst performing. Gaye did eventually release his first solo hit in September 1963, Stubborn Kind of Fellow. Further hits led to Gaye becoming a rising star and scoring collaboration with Tammy Terrell, leading to the absolute worldie of a bop, Ain't No Mountain High Enough. In 1967, Terrell collapsed in Marvin's arms when performing live in Farmville, Virginia. It was found that she had a malignant brain tumour, ending her live performing career. Whilst they continued to record under supervision, Marvin was devastated with her illness and became disillusioned with the business, almost throwing in the towel. It was at this crisis point that two huge milestones were achieved in 1968. First, Marvin performed the national anthem at the 1968 World Series in Detroit. Also, Gaye released I Heard It Through the Grapevine, which became his first Billboard number one and is an absolute sensation. I don't know if anyone else gets this, and maybe I'm being petty, but it really bloody cheeses me off when these absolute anthems of huge historical significance become like advert songs, like they use that for an injury lawyer type service, I think. They've used Queen for bloody sofa adverts. Like, when I hear Freddie Mercury sing, I want to think of Live Aid and the great music videos they made, not up to 60% off Ottomans at DFS. Sadly, Gaye believed he didn't deserve his success, and he was merely a puppet of producers. Tammy Terrell died in March 1970 from brain cancer. Gaye entered into a depression and actually tried to become an American football player for the Detroit Lions. He befriended some of the players and tried out, but was declined for fear of him becoming injured and jeopardising his music career. Fun fact is that some of those players for the Detroit Lions actually are backing vocals for Marvin Gaye's song What's Going On. On the 1st of June 1970, Gaye recorded that very song. If you haven't listened to it, what are you doing? It's one of my favourite songs of all time, and one I firmly believe is one of the greatest songs of all time. I know art is subjective, but I feel if you could assign objective scores to songs, it would be a 10 out of 10. The song was inspired by police brutality at an anti-war rally in California. Producer Berry Gordy refused to release it due to its political nature and for fear of losing Gaye's white audience. In response, Gaye went on strike and refused to release material at all. The song was eventually released, thank the heavens, and it became number one for 5 weeks. The album of the same name was a rip-roaring success and netted Gaye 2 Grammy nominations. It is one of the finest albums ever produced. Fight me. In 1973, Gaye released another album, Let's Get It On, another belter. The title track became Gaye's second number one on the Hot 100 and stayed on the chart for 2 years. 2 years, that's the length of the career of most bands these days, to be honest. Gaye duetted with Diana Ross, a collab that was received very well despite the opposing styles of the two artists. Live shows on the back of this helped enhance Gaye's reputation as a live performer. At one point, he was earning $100,000 a night, over $500,000 now cash. Do a week, never work again. What a life. All was not peaches and cream though, as it never is. Gay's high-rolling lifestyle led to a reliance on cocaine. His mental health was exceptionally fragile, and this was exacerbated by the fact he hated touring. In 1983, after a period as a European tax exile, as you do, Gay was back in the limelight with a single, Sexual Healing, and the album Midnight Love. He had achieved sobriety during a stint in Belgium. Returning to the US, he embarked on a sexual healing tour and old demons came knocking. He started using cocaine again and developed paranoia that someone wanted to kill him, even resorting to wearing a bulletproof vest on stage. Crew member Eric Sharp committed suicide on the tour, which of course had a very harsh effect on Gay. In August 1983, Gay returned to his parental home after the end of the tour to care for his sickly mother. The house had been bought by Marvin for his parents a decade earlier. That October, Marvin Sr. returned from a business trip. For the next 6 months, the two men struggled to keep out of each other's way, bickering fairly regularly. One occasion saw the patriarch call the police to remove his son. Jean, Marvin's sister, said that their dad said that if Junior ever touched him, he'd kill him. Gay irritated his father more by having fairly constant company of friends and drug dealers coming to the house, up to 30 people a day. For Christmas that year, Marvin gave his father a .38 Smith & Wesson pistol to protect himself from intruders. I remember when I was buzzing when I got a Robo Sapien and Shrek on VHS. Swings and roundabouts, I suppose. Marvin's mental health continued to decline, and he reportedly rarely spoke of much else other than death and suicide. He even tried to take his life by jumping from a speeding vehicle, but only suffered bruises. He would often wear multiple coats and mismatched shoes. Arguments between Senior and Marvin's mother began over misplaced insurance letters. Gay would often intervene and defend his mother, often berating his father for his loud tirades against his mother. On April 1st, 1984, around 12:30 p.m, another argument broke out, Marvin Senior screaming through the house about the letter. Gay leapt out of bed and demanded his father say anything he needed to her face. Senior came up to the room, with Gay ordering him to get out. When his father refused, Gay shoved him out of the room and began punching and kicking him. Albertus screamed at the pair to stop to no avail. Senior left for a moment and came back armed with the gun. He pointed at his son and fired. The shot struck him through the heart. Alberta recalled, "I screamed, but it was all very quick." Marvin screamed, slid to the floor. The shot proved to be fatal. It entered Gay's chest, hitting his lung, heart, liver, and stomach before exiting his left side. Marvin Sr. then stepped forward and shot him again at point-blank range. Alberta, terrified of becoming a second victim, ran from the house screaming. She ran towards the guest house where Gay's brother Frankie and sister-in-law Irene were and proclaimed, "He shot Marvin. He killed my boy." Wow. Frankie ran to the house and made his way to his brother's room. He cradled Gay in his arms. Gay, barely alive, whispered to his brother, "I got what I wanted. I couldn't do it myself, so I got him to do it for me. I've run my race. There's no more left in me." Police arrived and arrested Marvin Sr., who sat on the porch. Gay was taken to the California Hospital Medical Center and was pronounced dead at 1 minute past one in the afternoon. He died the day before his 45th birthday. During an interview with police, Marvin Sr. said he only meant to shoot in self-defense. He didn't even think the gun was loaded. When asked if he loved his son, he said, "Let's say I didn't dislike him." He wept when he was told his son had died. Gay's siblings actually said that it was a case of premeditated suicide and that Marvin achieved three things during the whole event. He put himself out of his misery for one, he saved his mother from her husband, and he ensured his father would suffer the rest of his life. On April 5th, 1984, Gay's funeral was held at Forest Lawn Cemetery. 10,000 people attended, Smokey Robinson delivered a eulogy, and Stevie Wonder performed. He was given a burial plot and was cremated with half his ashes spread in the Pacific Ocean and half given to his wife and son. Gay left no will, which meant his 17-year-old son became executor of his entire estate. Unpaid tax and back alimony amounted to debts over $1 million. Royalties from Gay's music managed to pay this off, however. Marvin Sr. was held in jail with $100,000 bond. Papers ran with his words of, "I didn't mean to do it." During a checkup at the medical center, a benign tumor was discovered at the base of his brain. This was removed and he was deemed fit to stand trial. He appeared in court on the 20th of June and was ordered for a preliminary hearing on July 16th. Alberta posted $30,000 bond to release him but had divorced him 2 days earlier. Looking at the autopsy and the injuries sustained by Marvin Sr., the judge offered him a plea bargain in which Marvin Sr. would be sentenced with voluntary manslaughter and have a 6-year suspended sentence with 5 years probation. During his sentencing, he tearfully told the court, "If I could bring him back, I would. I wish he could step through this door right now." During the course of his sentence, Gay Sr. suffered ill health and was moved to a nursing home. He died of pneumonia on October 10th, 1998, 9 days after his 84th birthday. News stations, of course, ran the story very quickly after the tragic death of Marvin, and the New York Times featured Gay on the front page. The death, of course, shook the music world and the world at large. Smokey Robinson recalls hearing about it on the radio and having to call Gay's wife in disbelief. Jermaine Jackson wept uncontrollably when told by Barry White. Vigils were held outside the property where the shooting occurred, with numerous memorials engulfing the entrance. Numerous artists have been influenced by Gay, including Barry White, Tupac Shakur, and Erykah Badu. According to biographer David Ritt, in his 1991 revision of his book about Marvin, Marvin's name has been mentioned in reverential tones in no less than 7 top 10 hit records. Many posthumous awards were given to Gay, including a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award and induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He has been revered as the Prince of Motown and the number one purveyor of soul music. Blimey, that was a fairly sad one. I hope you're all still with me. Such a shame for a bright talent to meet such an end and to struggle so much during their life. Something you could do to make you feel better though, go listen to the album What's Going On. It's a force of nature, and to have it grace your ears is an utter pleasure, and it might take the edge off a bit. Nice way to remember Marvin Gaye too. May he rest in peace. Right, the busy bits now. If you fancy updates on the show, do follow at John Doe & Co Pod on Insta and Twitter and TikTok for those that prefer little videos. Rate, review and subscribe on your podcasting app, please, as would love to see more thoughts here. Head on over to Patreon at patreon.com/JohnDoeAndCoPod and donate. It's mainly about supporting the show right now, but some cool bonuses coming soon. Feel free to DM any suggestions or what you'd like to see, as always. Scotland, Scotland, a beautiful place full of wonder and mystery, the land of haggis and iron brew. It's also got its own cryptids too, creatures of myth and legend. Are we covering Nessie? No, she's had plenty of attention. Next time, we're having a look at the Grey Man. Sounds like Jacob Rees-Mogg, but it's far more interesting and likeable. Should be a wacky time, and I hope to see you there. Thanks for being such good company. Until next time.